Hello everyone and welcome to Boat Briefing. My name is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, Features Director of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of super yachting is Sophia Wilson, our Acting Deputy Editor. Now I'm going to have to dust off my microphone, or should I say our microphone, because we're in the same room this week, because I've had a bit of a hiatus because I've been off on honeymoon in Antigua. So working hard, or hardly working, as my friend Ali would say.
Well, first of all, a big welcome back to the pod, Charlotte, and congratulations on becoming Mrs. Ellis. Although for podcast and work purposes, I believe you're staying as Hogarth Jones for the time being.
I am. I think the boat design team are annoyed with that because it's obviously a much longer name to cram onto all the bylines. But yeah, I am. I don't want my Pulitzer Prize winning boat pieces disappearing into the ether. But yeah, if you see a particularly bad piece by a Mrs. Ellis, you can know that that's probably me as well.
Yeah, a pen name for the future.
Exactly.
Anyway, how was Antigua, one of my favourite places?
It was absolutely stunning. I'd never been before. I know that you go a lot for the chef's yacht chef competition that happens there every year. But I'd never been before and it was just gorgeous. I can see why owners love it so much and always rave about it. Just the most incredible beaches, that's the main thing. Crystal clear waters, amazing sand, really lovely people. It was slightly affected by the pandemic. It didn't spoil things at all, but it was interesting. While I was there, there was a 2-week lockdown, so that was kind of bad timing for us.
Didn't it come in while you were on the plane?
It did, yeah, it did. We arrived in Antigua to a big list of restrictions. And it sounded, I have to say, it sounded a bit bleak, largely because you couldn't stay on the beach past 5 p.m. on a weekday or 12 p.m, so midday on a weekend. And they did enforce that. They had kind of police boats out in the water. But actually, you know, at 5 p.m, that's normally the end of a day where you're thinking about a cocktail or going for a shower or whatever. So that didn't really affect us. 12 p.m. on the weekend was doable. And it's over now anyway. So if you visit now, that's not going to be an issue for you. And a few of the hotels were closed, I think partly coronavirus, partly hurricane season. But I would absolutely urge anyone to go. You know, speaking to some of the locals on the beach, they were saying it's been really quiet for them. It's been a difficult period. Jolly Harbour, which is just down the road from where I was staying, was not as jolly as it had been in previous years, and they were missing it. But from my perspective, you know, what a perfect time to go. The beaches were really quiet, so sometimes it felt like you had your own kind of private dream beach. It's a lovely part of the world. And I just think, yeah, if you're umming and ahhing over where to go next and where to take your super yacht, do something good for humanity. Head down to Antigua, drink pina coladas all day. I really recommend it, and you'll have a fabulous time.
And was there anywhere in particular that stood out or that you particularly enjoyed? Did you make it down to Falmouth Harbour? Or did you stay away from yachts as you were?
Yachts were sadly sort of off limits just for that 2 weeks. And I was working my way through a number of books anyway. But yeah, we went to a number of different hotels. One of them was Blue Waters, which was lovely and has an incredible restaurant looking out over the ocean, which was fantastic. We also went to Sheer Rocks, courtesy of boat, which was very kind. We went to the restaurant there. Again, a really amazing view. And we ended up at a place called Escape at Nonsuch Bay, which is sort of surrounded by mangroves and things, not with a big sandy beach, but was quite a different experience to the other places. So a lovely, lovely trip.
Yeah, Sheer Rocks is a real yachty fave. I know Eddie Jordan likes popping in there.
It had a distinct party vibe. There were some people behind us who were working their way through the rosé magnums and seemed to really be enjoying themselves. But meanwhile, you've been hard at work picking up all the slack, and you did this week's interview. So can you tell us a bit more about who it was and what you talked about?
Yeah, so I caught up with Captain Kelly Gordon, who is in charge of 32-metre San Lorenzo Freddy. And I spoke to her on the boat in Fort Lauderdale, which is always a slightly scary experience when you're interviewing the captains, because you're never quite sure whether their radio is about to go off at any moment.
How much time you've got.
But we got through it. She has a pretty amazing backstory. So she was a chemistry professor and only discovered yachting when she was invited to a party on an 80-foot yacht. She's now been in the industry for 13 years and recently took the helm of this popular charter yacht, which is managed by Ocean Independence. We cover off quite a bit in the interview, but of course we talk about her experience as a female captain in the industry, which, let's face it, is still quite a rarity. We talk a bit about what can be done more to encourage more women into the industry and maybe more women to think about jobs on deck rather than just taking those interior roles, and just making, I think, women aware that those opportunities exist. She's a pretty straight talker, and she makes some really interesting points, so make sure you stay tuned for that once Charlotte and I have covered off all the news and data. Now, Charlotte, you only came back to the office last week, but in true boat style, you then headed straight off to Genoa on a work trip. How was it?
I did. It was great. You know, it was great to be back traveling for work rather than pleasure. But it was a bit of both because obviously the Italians are such amazing hosts. And I can't say I didn't put away a fair amount of pasta while I was there. So I was there to see a boat that the famous architect Renzo Piano is designing. If you haven't heard of him, he designed the Shard in London, amongst so many other things. And he's basically won the sort of the Pulitzer Prize for architecture, essentially. Anyway, he's been working on this 24 meter called MY Zattera. Zattera means the raft in Italian, and it's named that because of its really unusual shape. More on that in a second. But he's been working on it. He's not owning it. It's a collaboration with the boat's owner, Olev Selvag, who's a Norwegian guy, and both of their wives, Emilia and Christine. But basically, they're all friends. They're actually all sailors, so this is a bit of a departure for them, and they go way back. So Olev is a property developer, and him and Renzo first met when they were working on a museum together in Norway 25 years or so ago. So yeah, the project is a kind of group vision. They came up with it while they were sailing in Sardinia, and they said that they wanted to make a super silent motorboat, but also something that was sustainable, that they could go on trips together on. So that's sort of where we're at the moment, and it's halfway done. The hull was put into the water this week. And yeah, it's an amazing looking yacht. It doesn't disappoint when you're thinking of kind of an amazing architect designing something radical. It's particularly wide. It has a 7.2 meters beam. And it almost reminded me of one of those sort of toy boats that children draw with really simple lines, because it is so minimal and pared back. And the deck is quite special. It's almost at water level. So they had this idea that it's like walking on water. And it does, you know, as they were lowering the boat into the water, it was kind of amazing seeing it going lower and lower and lower to the point where you thought, when are they going to stop? Okay, no, that's it. But yeah, very clean lines. It's amazing water level. And then it's also going to have a hybrid system for the sustainability part. It's going to have solar panels on the roof of the glass superstructure, which is the next step, and some Siemens batteries, so that it's kind of hybrid power system. And it is almost silent. Like, he looked delighted when the yacht was leaving the yard and going for a little test run. He said, you know, what can you hear? You can't hear anything, can you? And he's right, it's very, very quiet. Anyway, if you want to read all about it, you can have a look online and get the full details of it. And while you're on our website, you might want to have a look at, we did a big piece a while ago about noise on board yachts and how to make your boat super silent. So I know it's a common complaint of owners that you've got one generator, or you've got something that keeps you up in the night and it drives you mad and it maybe makes you want to buy a new boat. But don't despair, there's plenty of things you can do, some amazing companies out there, and just some incredibly quiet boats. You know, have a read of that and hear some impressive stats.
And in terms of the timeline, when is that glass superstructure going to be put in place?
Well, I can tell you, mixed reports from the people I managed to pin down, but they're certainly not rushing it. I think for them, especially for Renzo, it's a bit of an experiment. Every meeting they have, I think the team there was slightly frazzled because they keep kind of changing ideas, changing plans. They even changed medium. At one point, the initial idea was for it to be built with reinforced concrete. Some people say they're trying to get it done for the summer season, and I think that's the aim. But certainly if there are things along the way that they want to change, they will do. So I'd expect to see it at some point next year, hopefully in time for the summer.
And presumably another benefit of it being so silent is that when you're on board and spending time, you can kind of chat and socialise, and you don't have, as you were saying, that kind of background noise behind it.
Yeah, I mean, some people in the yard have been saying, you know, it's quiet enough that when you're out on the ocean, you can make a phone call and someone wouldn't necessarily know you're at sea, which, you know, wow. And we know that noise is becoming an increasing thing as people are working more on board, as well as just wanting a quieter experience when they're out there with their guests.
Yeah, well, on that note, Espen told our business editor, Nick, the other day that apparently a lot more owners are asking for classrooms on board.
Yeah.
Which is something that we have spoken about before. And Cecile, our executive editor in the US, wrote a brilliant piece looking at educating children when you take them on longer voyages and the different approaches that parents have taken. the son of one owner was actually made to turn up in his school uniform for lessons every day while they're on a global tour, which is obviously at one end of the kind of structured scale.
Hope it wasn't really one of those really hot woolen blazers.
I'm not actually sure how old his son was at the time, but that is exactly what I picture, is the kind of knee-high socks and everything else. But I think it is something that it didn't surprise me when Nick said that, because I think post-COVID people are thinking more and more about how they're going to use their yachts and potentially using them for longer periods. And I guess then, you know, education does become a bigger part of that rather than just using them in the holidays.
Yeah, I mean, some of the boats we talked about a while ago, when we were looking at kind of kids' spaces on board, they had, one of them had a laboratory for the child's science lessons, and Artifact, you know, we know has got loads of press lately and has a big kind of children's craft space. And definitely people are changing how much time they spend on board and who they spend it with. At the shipyard where Renzo's boat is being built at Castagnola, which is in Lavagna, just outside of Genoa, they were saying, without a doubt, they've had loads of requests. And I was surprised to hear this, but they said it's a big thing that, whereas previously an owner wanted an office just for themselves to do a bit of business while on board, now they're asking for whole kind of company offices, essentially. That, you know, they start off by saying, actually, it would be great if my PA could come and join me. Can we get a berth for them? And then they, you know, steadily add to it. So they're now adding, you know, they're getting a request for 4 or 5 berths, extra sort of separate rooms next to an office where they can have company meetings going on. And I think that all ties into people just loving being at sea. Presumably some of these people, you know, made the move during the pandemic to spending more time on board, and actually they're finding, hey, I like never leaving my boat behind, and this life is the life for me. And yeah, you can blame them.
I think we should put it to our CEOs. I think the Boat International.
Yeah, the boat.
The boat. I mean, it's an obvious solution,
so.
Surely.
I think so. And actually, while we're talking about the changing shape of yacht design and different arrangements and that sort of thing, we should mention our annual Super Yacht Design Festival, which is looming into view on the horizon. This year, rather than the snowy mountains of Cortina, it'll be in what would some people would call the home of design, controversial perhaps, but it's going to be in the city of Milan in Italy. So we'll be releasing information about speakers throughout the coming weeks. There are some great names on stage, including some other architects. Stefano Bueri is the keynote speaker. He made the amazing Bosco Verticale, the living city. I know, he went straight for that one. He made that in Milan and some incredible buildings. And also Patricia Veal, she's one half of the studio Citterio Veal, and she's just made the custom Navetta, which was very exciting, and is going to tell us all about that. So yeah, if you haven't got your tickets yet, now's the time to do so. They're up on our site, boatinternational.com, and it's going to be great.
So continuing with a little bit of housekeeping, before the Super Yacht Design Festival, we have another 2-day event, the Festival of Yachting, which is perhaps why Charlotte and I are both looking a little bit frazzled, because it's quite a busy time in the office. This event incorporates 2 days, so it's the Life Under Sail Conference and the Explorer Yacht Summit, being held on Wednesday the 10th and Thursday the 11th of November at the Yacht Club in Monaco. It promises to be 2 days of great insight into both sectors of the market, with a brilliant selection of owners and industry experts lined up as speakers. There's lots more information about it on the website, and tickets are also available there. You can either buy a ticket for each event or for the entire 2 days. We'll move on to some proper news shortly, but Charlotte, I know you're a huge fan of The Crown, and as you've been away for a few weeks, there haven't been any updates, but I have a couple of filming updates for you. The first is that the cast have been spotted in Mallorca filming on board the 99-metre Christina O, which is obviously a very iconic yacht in her own right.
Beautiful boat.
The yacht's reportedly used to film scenes of a family holiday with Prince Charles and Princess Diana and the princes, which took place in the early 90s, shortly before their marriage kind of fell apart publicly. The actual trip did take place, but it was on a 121-metre yacht called Alexander. Now, I've done a bit of digging because I kind of got into a royal yacht rabbit hole yesterday afternoon, and with the help of our wonderful data guru Raphael, Alexander is apparently still on the water, and her latest ARS report was kind of earlier this year, but she is in the Red Sea, I believe, and it's thought she's still owned by the same family, but she clearly wasn't available for the filming. But Christina O makes a pretty great replacement as an iconic yacht's go.
Absolutely.
So the Christina O sighting comes hot after the crew were also spotted on board the 73-metre Lursen Titania. This yacht was reportedly being used to play the Code Casa yacht named Bash, which was historically known as Jonical. I'm not sure whether that pronunciation is quite right, which of course belonged to the Egyptian businessman and former Harrods owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. So there'll be lots of yacht spotting to be doing when the new series is aired, which I don't think is actually until November 2022. So we've got a little while to wait. But yeah, plenty of yachts involved to keep you up to date with Charlotte.
Thank you very much. Okay, so from our weekly telly news update to the real news, what else has been going on so far?
So yeah, there have been a few stories that have caught our eye in the office this week. The first is that the third Benetti Diamond 44 metre has been launched. Called Lucky Wave, the launch took place at Benetti's Viareggio site using the shipyard's historic 56-metre inclined slipway, which actually dates back to 1873. This is the third hull in the fiberglass series, and the yacht follows Ink, which was launched in 2020, and Donna Santa Jew, which was delivered earlier this year. Giorgio Cassetta is responsible for her exterior lines, while her interior was handled in-house by Benetti's design team. There are currently three more Diamond 44 units under construction at the yard, so it certainly seems to be a series that's proving popular.
Fantastic. Well, I've got something I spotted on the site. Ocean Independence has revealed an 107.35-metre Dynarig sailing concept called Project Sonata. Advertised with a build time of 38 months, Project Sonata was designed by Valentin Design, which was asked to create a buildable, eco-friendly superyacht of tomorrow in collaboration with German shipyard Lloyd Werft. Well, she does look amazing. I'm not sure I've ever seen a skinnier superyacht. It's sort of the Kate Moss of yachts, very, very skinny, built from a steel hull and aluminium superstructure. She's going to be powered by twin 1,100-kilowatt electric engines for a top speed of 17 knots and a cruising speed of 15 knots. Elsewhere, the yacht features battery packs capable of powering the hotel service for 12 hours without the need of generators and a retractable keel for a reduced draft. Further energy can also be recovered through the propellers while sailing. Anyway, she's very sleek and sexy. The master cabin in particular looks very James Bond, with sort of curved glass surround and a pool just outside on the doorstep, so do go and check it out.
Yeah, it's a really exciting concept. Stuart and I actually had a kind of debate last week on the podcast as to where the line blurs between ridiculous concepts and concepts that actually bring some really interesting ideas. And I think she's definitely on that side.
Yeah.
Even if that yacht doesn't end up being built, she might do, it would be some of the ideas on her. It'd be great to see kind of
filtering
into the sailing yacht community.
Definitely.
So the last bit of news that we wanted to talk about this week was that Rossetti Superyachts has released images of its 37.83-metre Explorer yacht, Emotion. This is the first yacht delivered by the Italian yard, which is best known for construction ocean-going supply vessels. The yard's revealed that its owners are an experienced couple who are closely involved with all aspects of the design and construction of the yacht. The yacht's interior was designed by Berdiso Capponi Yachts and Design, while Hydrotech penned her exterior. One of the yacht's standout features, which obviously caught my eye, is that it has a 150-bottle wine cellar, which actually acts as a divider between the guest areas and the owner's stateroom, clearly an essential for any long voyages.
I like the idea of dividing myself from people with wine.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, what a way to social distance to ensure people can't come close to you with the barrier of wine. Just genius idea.
I might implement it at home.
Yeah, exactly. I could do something similar.
The full yacht report will be in our December issue. And if you can't wait until then, we actually have snuck it up a bit early on the Boat International website. So do go and have a look. And that has much more details, both about the wine cellar, but also about some of the yacht's other facilities. And it's also been designed with a real eco-friendly pedigree as well. So it's a really interesting report to read.
Okay, that's it for this week's news. And now on to the data, where we're going to look at the current fleet. Always interesting, we think, to take stock and look at what's around us right now. So here we go. The current fleet contains 11,712 yachts. The vast majority of these are motor yachts, 9,856 of them, with 1,856 of them being sailing yachts. There's a fairly even split between custom and semi-custom. There are 4,493 custom and 7,219 semi-custom. But this ratio changes as the boat gets bigger. So when you look at yachts that are around 30 to 34 metres, for example, 72.6 of them are semi-custom. But once you get to 50 to 69 metres, that drops to 21.2%. And by the time you're looking at yachts that are 100 metre plus, only about 3.8% of them are semi-custom, which is probably what you might expect when you get into this kind of bigger, more ambitious territory. Most sailing yachts, however, are fully custom. There's 1,340 of them, and 516 of them are semi-custom.
I mean, I think you'd expect that with sailing yachts for so many more of them to be full custom, but it comes back to, we've actually got a panel at the Life Under Sail conference looking at whether is sailing too complicated and is that what's putting some people off? And I guess if you, with motor yachts, there's so many more, you know, semi-custom options available that feel a little bit more accessible if you're coming to the market. Whereas if you're kind of going full custom from the start, I do wonder whether that seems a bit intimidating. I'm sure the panel of experts will be able to share much more insight into that.
Maybe a bit much to take on for some people. Anyway, most boats in the fleet are straight motor yachts, but 840 of them are sport boats. 714 of them are explorers, but that's also including sort of trawler type yachts. And 263 of them are sport fishing boats, something that we know are big in the US in particular, if you're listening over there. So in terms of who's building the current fleet then, Italy is way out in front, accounting for 4,152 of them. Then the USA, UK and Netherlands follow behind at 1,821, 1,013 and 952 respectively. Turkey and Taiwan are next, they're pretty close. 673 of them are built in Turkey and 613 in Taiwan. And then Germany, France, Canada and New Zealand are the remaining countries in the top 10. It's worth noting as well that these 10 nations account for 87% of the global fleet. So if you own a yacht, it's most likely built in one of these places. And that's something that doesn't look about to change anytime soon. So that's it for this week. That's our little look at the current fleet. And it's been great to be back, obviously. Stay tuned and listen to Sophia's interview with Captain Kelly.
Well, welcome back, Charlotte. And yeah, afraid more of me up next, but Captain Kelly is very great and very insightful. So okay. Don't despair. Hi, Captain Kelly. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Whereabouts are you joining us from?
I'm in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
And you're the captain on board 32-meter San Lorenzo, Freddy. How long have you been on board for?
I've been on board for about 6 months now, so it's still a fairly new command for me. And thanks for having me today, by the way.
Pleasure. We're delighted you could join us. And how are you finding it being on board? What are your plans for the upcoming Caribbean season?
Oh my gosh, I am so happy. We're, you know, it's September, October, so everybody's doing their traditional shipyard period, and we just got out of the yard. And so we're actually in a few days getting ready to head over to the Bahamas. We're a pretty busy charter boat, and we spend quite a bit of time over in the Bahamas. So that's where we're getting ready to go. But I love this new command, and I love the boat. I love the crew. And so I'm super thrilled to have this new position.
And you mentioned that she's quite a busy charter boat. Do you know how many weeks you're looking to do this winter season of charter?
You know, this boat would stay as busy as I would let it. It would probably charter full time, but I sat down with the manager when I came on board, and he said, you know, he was trying to build a healthy program and not burn out his crew, because he was realizing that crew fatigue was a real thing. And I said, you know, why don't we try to keep it an average of 2 weeks a month? So that's what I'm shooting for. There were some maintenance items and some upkeep that I wanted to do, some projects, big projects that I wanted to do straight away. I knocked out 3 charters in about 5 weeks' time as soon as I took over the vessel. And then we came back over here to do a little bit of work, went back over, and then we went into our shipyard period. But I think what I'm trying to do to focus on crew fatigue but still have a busy and successful charter program is to do about two week-long charters a month. So that would give us theoretically a week on, week off, but even if they were back to back. But you know, if I had to squeeze in the busy season, if I had to do 3 weeks in a month, I would.
And what do you think makes her such a popular charter yacht?
Honestly, she's a really sexy looking boat. I think the Italians do a great job with maintaining a really modern and sleek line. The boat itself, when you just are shopping for a charter boat and you see the photos of it, she really just shows so well. But she's also a 5 stateroom boat. So the fact that we've got that extra stateroom really makes a difference. We've got quite a few toys and the crew, of course. We've got a really good crew now.
And how does she compare to other boats that you've worked on in the past?
oh, she's nice. She's just, she's so comfortable. She handles so well when we're at sea. She's great on anchor. The setup for the toys, the setup for the entertaining and for the guests. I think it's probably one of the nicest boats that I've been on. What's funny is that I cut my teeth in this industry on an older San Lorenzo. And so here I am 13 or so years later, back on a San Lorenzo, but a much newer one. And it's interesting. A lot of the things, some of the things are still the same, but they function so well when it comes to entertaining guests and even entertaining owners. We were out last night, the boss was on, and it was his anniversary, and even just having him and their little one on, it's still set up so well for really just almost anything that you want to do.
And you mentioned you're going back to the Bahamas. Where are some of your favorite parts of the Bahamas to cruise?
Oh, I hands down the Exumas. I am just so in love with the Exumas. I've been a lot of places. I've been all over the Caribbean. I've been to Cuba. I've been all up and down the Eastern Seaboard, and hands down, and I've been all over the Bahamas. Prior to coming to onboard with Freddie, I lived over there for a year, and hands down, the Exumas are my favorite. And recently we kind of discovered a little bit of a hidden gem in the Exumas that not a whole lot of charter boats go to. Typically when you charter a boat in the Exumas, they'll run from typically Highborn down to Staniel. And just past Staniel is an area called Little Farmers. And we started adding that to our itinerary just with our last trip. And we found just some really cool snorkeling spots and some hidden little caves and some really unique locals. And so that last stop that we've just added on has started to become one of my favorites. But hands down, the Exumas for me.
And you mentioned that you started out on a San Lorenzo, so you've kind of come full circle 13 years later. I mean, it feels kind of ridiculous to say this, but in 2021, you're still one of the very few female captains out there. How did you get into the yachting industry and end up on that first San Lorenzo?
You know, it was totally by accident. When I got into the industry, I thought that, you know, that everybody comes into this industry having grown up on boats and been boating since they were in diapers. And I realized everybody's comes into this industry a little bit differently. And mine definitely was. It wasn't the traditional way that I was thinking. I was a chemistry professor before I was a yacht captain. And I was working full-time on the coast of North Carolina. And a student of mine was a non-traditional student, meaning that she was older and coming back for a second degree. And she was a huge part of the community and saw that I was new to the area and wanted to show me around. And after grades were turned in and the semester was over, she invited me out to a party on a motor yacht. And just immediately, I was intrigued. I think it comes from having grown up on a farm where I was around heavy equipment and constantly working with my hands and such, and just watching and seeing the massiveness of the vessel and how it was maneuvered instantly intrigued me. And I was like, I want to do this. And it literally took off from that day.
So what was the next stage from there? So you're at a party on a motor yacht, thought this is for me. How did it then progress?
I've always been a little bit brazen and bold. And I just looked at the captain and said, I can drive this thing. And he just looked at me like, really? You think so? And he actually said that. And I said, yeah, I do. And he says, come back tomorrow. And I was like, oh, Lord, what did I just get myself into? And I did. I literally came back tomorrow. And I think in hindsight, I stayed with that vessel for 8 years. And what he saw with me was my drive, my thirst for knowledge. And he just took me under his wing and it just went. And I want to say I was lucky in a way, but I also want to say that you create your own luck. And the fact that I spoke up and I said, I can do this, even though I didn't know port from starboard or bow from stern. I just knew that it was something that piqued my curiosity, and it was something that I wanted to try to do. I'd always loved the water. You know, we grew up on lakes and rivers and such, and I'd always loved the water, and I just ran with it.
So when he first had you on board, what did he do? Like, how did he start training you up?
He made sure that I spent a little bit of time in every department, because he told me, because he asked me, he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, hello, I want to be the captain. And he was like, well, you just can't start there, you know? And so he made sure that I spent a little bit of time in every department. So obviously, you know, he was the captain of the vessel, he ran it. So I started off as deckhand. But it was an 80-foot San Lorenzo, so it ran with a smaller crew. So I got to spend time on the exterior, time on the interior, and then it wasn't long before he said, hey, you know, if you really want to do this, you need to spend some time in the engine room as well. You know, you don't exactly have to be able to rebuild an engine, but you need to be able to be down there to do some basic troubleshooting and talk the talk for when you do have an issue. So I was lucky in that I got to spend a little bit of time in every department, minus the galley. That's never been a strong suit of mine, so I stay away from the galley unless it's to run the microwave. But so no, I was really, really lucky to have run into someone such as himself.
And do you think your chemistry background helped with some of that, some of the more technical side in terms of kind of logical and thought process?
Oh God, yes, yes. I use chemistry every day. One of the things that you want to think about, electrolysis, that's hugely chemistry. Batteries are hugely chemistry. I've also spent some time in the Great Lakes just understanding the process of changing out your anodes from magnesium to zinc. I use chemistry hugely, sometimes not even knowing it. And with my crew, sometimes they laugh and joke at me because they'll ask a question and I'll start to get on my soapbox and go straight into, you know, what used to be a 3-hour lecture for me. And they're like, well, you just want the outline, not the lecture. So, I use it hugely, but I also find that I have brought along my ability to troubleshoot from that, you know, where I learned to troubleshoot along the way. You know, I learned that on the growing up on a farm, but probably really dialed in on that ability all the way through college. So I would say that it has definitely played a huge role. You know, some would say, how do you go from chemistry to yachting? And it's a very, very awkward path, but the two very much go together.
And when you started off in yachting, do you think you were aware of how male dominated the industry was and still is to an extent, particularly for kind of captains?
I was and I wasn't. And the reason that I say that I wasn't is because my mom has always raised, I have a older sister and a younger brother, and my mom has always raised us, especially us girls, to go after whatever you want, to be whatever you want, to do whatever you want. You know, when I told her I wanted to be an astronaut, she was supportive. When I told her I wanted to be the first female president of the United States, she was supportive. When I told her I wanted to drive the trash truck, she was supportive. So I've always had this frame of mind that I can do and be whatever I want. But also, having grown up on a farm, I was always around the boys. I was a welder for a while, so that was obviously very male-dominated. And science, chemistry is very male-dominated. I've always gravitated towards male-dominated fields, and yes, I see it. So get to the yes, the yes and the no. The no is because my mom's raised me to just go after it. The yes is it's right there in front of your face. How can you not see it? And with yachting, even though I didn't know anything about the industry, you can just kind of guess and get this vibe and get this feel that you've got this huge, massive piece of equipment. It's probably going to be men running it. Now, does that make it right? No, it doesn't. And how do I have that feeling stepping on this motor yacht for the first time I've been on any motor yacht? And how do I instantly get that feeling that being a captain is a male-dominated role? How do I know that instantaneously? So what is it in our society or our upbringing that just lets us get a vibe and know that men do this and women do that? I mean, that's a whole rabbit hole we could go down.
Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to solve that in a half an hour chat. And then how have you, you know, you obviously kind of were semi-aware but not fully aware, and then how have you found it over the past, you know, kind of 13 years, you know, moving up and being on different vessels?
I have to say the men in this industry are my biggest cheerleaders. They are awesome. I can say out of all of the men that I know in this industry, and that's obviously a ton of them, there's two that are not supportive. And one of them, it's a cultural thing. Another one's just a grump. So when you look at it like that, I mean, I have a huge support system. The men have just been so awesome, so supportive, answer all my questions. They're my biggest cheerleader. When I hit a roadblock, you know, they know it, they sense it, they call me up, they push me along. They're awesome in this industry. The women too, you know, there's only a handful of us female captains. And so we've got to all support one another. And the women, the other female captains in this industry are some of my best friends. And it's amazing. But so it kind of, I think it goes without saying that the women, since there's so few of us, that we're definitely going to support one another. But I think that from the outside, if you're not in the industry, you might think that the men are a little bit scary, or, you know, if you think of yourself as a young woman trying to join into this industry and you're like, yes, I want to run one of those vessels. I want to be a captain someday. And you look at these massive vessels, and then you look at these men that carry themselves in such a manner, and they seem so scary, but they're so not. They are just, they're so kind, and they so want to share their knowledge and what they know and help people move forward. So they've been some of my biggest cheerleaders.
And on the kind of client side, both in terms of charter clients but also bosses that you've had over the years, how have you found that? Have any of them taken it by surprise, or do you actually think it's a positive because you're a bit different and you know maybe stand out from the crowd if they're looking at four or five different captains for a new role?
That's tough. So I have gotten jobs because I'm a woman, and I have lost jobs because I'm a woman. So let me go to the I've lost jobs because I'm a woman. I applied to a job, it's been a couple of years ago, and I ended up not taking the job. It just wasn't a good fit for me. But the manager said to me, just because we got into conversation and we got on really, really well, and he said to me, he says, I'm curious. He said, how do you think being a woman in the industry affects you? And I said, well, I certainly think that it does. And I said, let me fast forward here. So I asked him from his perspective as a hiring individual. And he says, I know many managers that as soon as they see that picture of the woman in that upper right-hand corner of the CV, they pass it right across the desk. They don't even look at their qualifications. And I'm like, man, what a bummer. You know, but then on the flip side, you know, I've talked to crew agencies in the last, call it 6 months when I was on the job hunt, and they're like, yes, we need more women in our repertoire. You know, we need to build this up. So it is slowly changing. So I have, and to be frank, I have interviewed with if you call the owners of the motor yacht, you know, typically husband and wife. I know that that's not always the way it is, but I'll generalize here. I'll interview with the husband. Everything will be great. He'll want to hire me. And then I'll interview with the wife, and the wife doesn't. So, I mean, you put fill in the blanks there, you know, that's unfortunate, you know, because I'm here to do a job, you know, so I don't know what's going on in the back end there that she doesn't want a female captain around, but it is what it is. But it's really disheartening to me, and it's extremely frustrating. But then the flip side of that, I said that I have gotten jobs because I'm a female. And you might say, well, whoa, wait a minute. That almost has a bit of a tone to it that just makes you go, ew, like almost, ooh, why? Well, so I have asked the men that I have run for that have said, I'll only hire female captains, or now that I've had a female captain, that's all I want moving forward. And with them, they say it's because women pay more attention to the detail. And then jokingly the other day, somebody said, if you want something done, give it to a woman. And I don't say this in any disrespect to my male counterparts, but for these owners that I've run for that now are partial to female captains have just felt that the woman pays more attention to the detail and they like that and more reserved. So maybe where you might have a man that would, let me just use an example, try to make a maneuver in maybe strong wind or current because his maybe pride's getting in the way, a woman's going to say, no, you know, and I know for myself, I'm going to be like, no, I don't think this is a good idea. You know, I'm going to tap out here. So some of that, you know, so in any instance that I've had an owner say that I prefer a female, it's never been in that creepy kind of way that you think it might have been.
And moving aside kind of from the gender debate for a bit, what do you think are some of the challenges generally of being a captain? And do you think they've kind of changed over your time in the industry?
One of the biggest challenges is crew management. That's hard. And I would say that that's probably what's always been hard. I mean, if you think even back to the day of when they had no instrumentation or any sort of luxuries that made navigation easier or made life on board easier, I bet that they would still say crew management is what makes the job tough. But I had somebody ask me the other day, what's your favorite part of the job? Aside from navigation and route planning and that part of it that really just trips my trigger, my favorite part of the job is crew. The most difficult part of my job is crew. So that's probably, I would say, even back in the days, you know, I would say that any captain that you would ask long ago would say that it's tough, you know, running a ship with many people, you know, you're working together, you're playing together, you're sharing a room together. So that's the tough part, but it's also the good part.
And the kind of challenges with crew, is it recruitment? Is it crew dynamics on board? Is it a bit of both?
It's both. Finding people that want to work and work hard is tough. And finding, gosh, this is where I'm really going to start to sound old and I'm going to start to sound like mom, my grandpa now, you know, like I find that your young folks, 20, 21, 22, feel like they ought to be making the big bucks straight out of the gate and don't realize you kind of got to pay your dues. Now, don't get me wrong. Talent and ability is not tied to age. So if you're really, really good, you know, like my mate and my chief stew are really, really good. So did I fight for the highest levels of pay for them? Yeah. Are they paid pretty high compared to what some 20 something years old are? Yes. But they're good. So I recognize that pay doesn't have anything to do with age, but also, generally speaking, you get better at your job and gain more skill with age. So then your pay goes up. And I find that finding, you know, typically your crew members are younger. And so when you're hiring the 22s and the 23s, number one, that work ethic is tough these days, and then they expect to be paid maximum pay. And that's hard. That's very hard. And then when you do get crew on board, creating a really cohesive dynamic on board is tough, you know, because you've got people from all walks of life and different ages and different backgrounds and home lives that you're trying to put together again, you know, 24/7. So it's tough.
And coming back to that kind of work ethic thing, are you seeing, I spoke to a few other captains about this, are you seeing a kind of below deck effect where, you know, people are watching the program and it makes yachting look one way and the reality of it, as we all know, is quite different from that? Do you think you're starting to see that, particularly with those lower level positions, the type of people that are applying, or not really?
You know, I have a different take on below deck. And maybe some of my counterparts might want to shoot me for saying this, but I'm going to be straight up with it. You know, and my crew do too. I think some of what you see on below deck, there's a lot of truth. It's a reality show, so it's dramatized. Okay, so yes, they dial it up a notch. But does the crew conflict happen? Yes. Do the mistakes happen? Yes. Do some of the charter guests get a little wild from time to time? Yes. So when I hear other folks in this industry say that they don't like below deck because it's not a real depiction of what goes on in this industry, I'm kind of like, I watch it and I'm kind of like, yeah, it really kind of is. I mean, yeah, it's dramatized, but it really kind of is. And I don't think anybody wants to be honest and say that. And I will, so I might get some backlash for that, but that's okay. So how's it been for bringing new folks into the industry? I think it's fantastic, because I grew up in middle America, in the middle of a cornfield, the furthest away from anything motor yachting. And it is totally by accident that I got into this industry. And I turned 40 a couple weeks ago, and I have to say I am the happiest I have ever been in my entire life. And a lot of it has to do with my position, with my career. And for the rest of the young folk, or any age really, that are sitting in the middle of the country, in the middle of any country, since you can watch Below Deck anywhere now, that don't know anything about motor yachts or the industry, and they see this, and maybe it makes them go, I want to do that. I want to pack my bag. I want to fly to school and take that basic training course, that first SCCW course, walk the docks and see if I can get on board and do something that I didn't know existed, that I had no idea, see the world. I want to do that. I think that's fantastic, because it's introducing them to something that they otherwise would have no idea was out there.
Yeah, we've discussed it on the podcast before. I do think it has made a lot more people aware of the world of yachting when they weren't, perhaps, in the past. I mean, I've really noticed it. Even friends and stuff now vaguely think they understand the industry that I'm involved with, where they just haven't had a clue in the past.
Yeah, and I mean, and if you get folks here that can't handle the long, you know, what sometimes seems like 25-hour work days, you know, they'll quickly weed themselves out. They will. But it's definitely a labor of love in this industry. But then you get the people here that some of them quickly realize, yes, this is for me. You know, I mean, you have to have a really strong work ethic to be in this industry. You know, I grew up on a farm, and that's where my work ethic came from. And my chief stew, her parents are South African yachties, and so that's where her strong work ethic came from. My mate grew up on the West Coast in Oregon, you know, doing fishing charter stuff. So he's used to the long hours. So, you know, you think about people from all over the middle of the country that are used to long hours and have that work ethic. They can bring that here to an industry that they never would have known existed, and would have never known that they could become a part of, and they see these young folks that have that don't have any prior experience joining these boats on below deck, and then they realize I can do that too. You know, I was delivering a boat from Florida to Chicago. So you're going from the bottom of the country to the top through the river system. And I'll never forget this little girl that I met as I pulled into this small marina off of one of the rivers, just comes out squealing, so excited to see a female captain. And she says to me, you know, I could never do this. I could never be like you. And I said, well, why? And she says, because I just live on this little river. And I said, well, you're at a better start than what I was, because I lived in the middle of a cornfield, you know? So I think it's good. It shows people, you know, that there are other avenues.
And I know another kind of passion area of recruitment for you is getting more women to think about joining on the deck side rather than just interiors. How have you found that, and why do you think that split exists as kind of extreme as the split generally is?
Oh, I am so hugely passionate about that. And, you know, I've tried not going down that rabbit hole as we've been talking. I'm like, oh, I want to go there. And I'm like, no, wait, just wait. She'll ask you about it. you know, I had such a great support system growing up with my mom, encouraging me to be and do whatever I wanted. And I still do. And being a chemistry professor, I've got such an affinity and love for the young adults, which is largely what's in this industry. And then every job I've ever had has been male dominated. And I'm at a point in my life where, like I said, I'm the happiest I've ever been. And my initiative, if that's what you want to call it, to get more women on deck is so much bigger than that. On a micro scale, yeah, it's to get more women on deck, because I know they're out there. And this shouldn't be... It shouldn't be like that. There's so many talented women out there. There's so many women out there that could run the hell out of a boat and should be. And I know the only thing that's preventing them from that is it just looks scary. These boats look scary. The men look scary. And I want them to know that it's not. It's not at all. In fact, the majority, the men, want to help you. So on a micro scale, yeah, my initiative is to get more women on deck. On a macro scale, it's because where I am in life right now. And to get to the happiest that I've ever been right now was a lot of work. It is not without saying that I haven't been down in the dumps. It's not saying that I haven't gone through some rough, rough, rough patches, and that I haven't been kicked in the gut climbing up the ranks in this industry. And it's more, you know, somebody told me once, if you don't share your story, nobody will. And it's more or less to tell people that you can do it. You know, it wasn't always easy coming along for me. And there were times that I wanted to give up in so many ways in the industry, in life. And now I'm so glad that I didn't. And I'm so happy with my career. I'm so happy with life now. And so on a macro scale, it's to encourage people to chase their dreams and to not quit on life. But yeah, on that micro scale, to get more women into the industry, because I know they're out there and I know they want to do it. And to let them know, you know, that it's not as scary as it looks. Yeah, it's going to take a little work, but that you can do it.
And practically, what are some of the things that you think needs to change for that to happen more often, or for more women to realize that there are opportunities on deck as much as there are in interiors?
You know, I think that if we could do something from the crew recruitment, because if you think about it, that's one of the biggest ways, one of the biggest doors into the industry is the recruiters. So if the recruiters could make a little bit of, more of an initiative to encourage and recruit women, or I don't know, could we have a Woman's Day job fair or something like that? Or could we pull together a group of men that wanted to be present at, it doesn't even have to be a boat show, but want to be present at, let's say, like a yachting job fair or something like that. I mean, the ideas are endless, and maybe have a panel of men that are there and welcoming, inviting, and speaking to these young women so that they know, oh, okay, you know, the guys aren't so scary. So you get that end on the very inside, letting the women know that you've got the support. But then at the very beginning, you know, where you've got the recruiters, you've got them maybe making a little bit more of an initiative. And like I said, a lot, some of them are, because when I reached out to a few of them a few months back, they were so excited. They're like, oh, another woman, you know, this is so great. We get to add a woman to our crew profiles. So if there were little, you know, here we are in Lauderdale, you know, the hub of yachting, if we had some sort of little career fair or something like that, that was devoted to just women, you know, men could come too, but to just women, something like that.
And do you think you are seeing some small changes?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I keep going back to it, but it was the few recruitment agencies that were excited and actually looking for, they told me that we've been looking to add more women. And that was really so cool. And I know my male counterparts and friends, you know, with me babbling on so much about how passionate I am, their eyes are a little bit more open now, to wider open to noticing if there's a woman that might want to be a part of the industry. Or, you know, I've just been out sometimes with the guys, and there's been a young woman on board or something like that, and they'll instinctively want to jump in and handle the lines and stuff like that. And I'll be like, no, let her do it. And so they just, I'm just seeing on a really small, just in my really small network of the men being more supportive and teaching and everything like that. So, but bigger with the agencies and smaller just, so yeah, I am seeing a difference.
And finally, hopefully ending on a positive note, how different do you think the yachting industry will look in 20 years time, when you've just had your 60th? What do you hope you'll see?
Oh, I think it's going to be amazing. I mean, the industry is amazing now, but I mean, in 20 years time, you know, you've got folks like Yachting International Radio that are out there telling, you know, the true story. You've got She of the Sea that's out there trying to mentor and push women along. And you've got myself, who's out there just, you know, trying to scream from the rooftops as well. And you've got recruiters that are trying to change the tone. I think in 20 years from now, and I know I'm missing a lot of people, so please don't shoot me, whoever's listening to this podcast, but in 20 years from now, it's going to be awesome.
Well, hopefully we'll catch up sooner than 20 years time, but I won't keep you any longer today, because I know you've got a boat to run. But thank you so much. It's been so great to hear your insights and your story.
Thank you so much for having me, and it really means a lot to me, because it's, as you know, it's something that I'm really passionate about. So thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.